Well, we were in Panama at this at the intertribal conference. As I mentioned, there were five different tribal groups there. About 70 people. And I asked those people, I think probably on the first day, I asked them, how many of you have either read or heard the end of the story? The end of what the Bible tells us. And out of a group of about 70, there was maybe 10 of them that had heard the end. Now, you know, we're talking about people who, some of them, they don't have the Bible yet in their language. Most of them do. At least they have the New Testament. But I don't know about you, but it's kind of frustrating when you don't hear the end of the story. Have you ever watched a DVD and it had a scratch on it 10 minutes before the end? That's frustrating. Just imagine, World Cup year, England, they might actually win a game. Jack doesn't think they're going to win their first game because he was born in Panama. But, you know, just imagine, here we are in the first half and England is winning. And there's a power cut. No, you don't want to imagine that, really, do you? But it would be frustrating. We want to know the end. We want to know if England really won. But for some reason, when it comes to the Bible, very often we treat it as a textbook. And we think that we can just skip around. But it's a story. The Bible tells us a story. It isn't our story, it's God's story, primarily, but it does tell us something about us too. It tells us things that are important. It tells us where we came from. It tells us why we exist. It tells us what our future is, and that some of what we're going to look at this evening. And the degree to which we see ourselves as part of that story, as part of God's story, is the measure of our maturity as believers. Okay, the amount that we actually see ourselves as part of God's story reflects our maturity, our spiritual maturity, if you like, as believers. So what we're going to do as part of this big picture series is look at almost the end of the story. Yeah, it isn't the end. And that's the point. That really, when we get to the end of the book, and I don't know if you've ever done this, when you're reading a novel even, and you're reading that story and you get to the end and you think, oh, I just wish there was more, yeah, because the writers, you know, the writer has done such a good job at getting you involved in the story, and you just think, oh, you know, I just wish there was a little bit more. Well, there is. There's a lot more. So that's what we're going to look at. I'm going to be reading from the New Living Translation, but feel free to follow along. We're going to obviously look at other passages too. But it says in verse 1 of Revelation 21. Verse 1 says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the old heaven and the old earth had disappeared, and the sea was also gone. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, like a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband." Now, obviously, there's a lot of imagery in the book of Revelation. And I don't know about you, but I've wondered sometimes, how does a city descend out of heaven dressed like a bride? Because most of the brides that I've seen, they wear, you know, long white dresses, and I've never seen a city in a long white dress. So there's a lot of imagery going on there. And to be honest, there were people with a lot more time and understanding than I have, who have spent a lot of time trying to figure all that imagery out. I'm happy to wait and see what it looks like when it happens. You know, one of the things about prophecy is I think that very often we try and guess what God's trying to do, when actually all he's doing is telling you, you know, when you see this, you'll understand that I'm in control. You know, so many of the prophecies have to do with things that we're going to think, well, you know, the world is in chaos. And Jesus said that, and he says, when you see these things, you know, the time is getting close. And so we can be comforted that God is still in control. And I think this is going to be one of those times when it actually happens, we'll all be like, oh, that's what he meant. I find it interesting that God sees fit to tell us that the sea is gone. Why does he do that? That the sea is all gone. Presumably that means all the sea creatures will also be gone. I have to admit, that kind of makes me sad. I mean, how many of you have watched The Blue Planet and you've just been fascinated, if not awestruck, by all the creatures that are living in the depths of the sea under huge amounts of pressure? And you think, why did God create those? Yeah, he went to all that trouble, and that we read here, it's all going to disappear. That type of thinking suggests to me that we have a very small view of God. Because for one thing, he didn't go to any trouble at all. Yeah? He created everything by the power of his word. It wasn't difficult for him to create those sea creatures. The reason he did it is because he's a creator. He is the creator, and he's creative. And so he did it just because he can. And I don't know if you've listened, well, you probably have, in The Blue Planet, you listen to David Attenborough talking about these places where nothing could possibly exist. You know, like in the Arctic Ocean. It's so cold and it's so deep and there's so much pressure there. Nothing exists. But there's something there. And it's almost like you can see God smiling as he says, you know, let's just leave something there. How does anything exist? And then down in the Mariana Trench, and there's these pipes with, you know, sulfuric acid coming out, and it's so hot down there, and so on. Nothing could possibly exist. And yet down there they go, and what do they find? You know, God has left creatures able to exist in that. Why does he do that? Because he can. Just because he's a creator. We'll come back to those creatures in a little bit. Then we look in these verses that we just read there. They're talking about, there you go, the new heaven, the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven like a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. Now, there's different theological positions as to who this new Jerusalem is. I'm not going to get into that, because it detracts from what I think is a central point here, that God himself has prepared his bride. If we read in Ephesians chapter 5, if you want to go there, you can. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, verses 25 to 27, it says, "For husbands," this means love your wives, "just as Christ loved the church, he gave up his life for her to make her holy and clean, washed by the cleansing of God's word. He did this to present her to himself as a glorious church without a spot or wrinkle or any other blemish. Instead, she will be holy and without fault. So, Sam, this is where you need to look away. We're beginning to get ready for Hannah's wedding. She has the dress, as you can see there. Maybe there'll be a few adjustments. We're looking for shoes, other accessories. Once September comes, there's going to be a mad rush. You know, final preparations and all that type of thing, all the different activity, the excitement as Sam and Hannah get ready for their wedding day. But what we face, or what we experience on earth, what they're experiencing, what, you know, any of us that are married have experienced, that excitement is nothing compared to the excitement in heaven. You know, personally, I think they're already, you know, in those final stages, you know, the final accessories, maybe decorating heaven or something, ready for the marriage feast. It won't be much longer before that wedding day comes. But for me, just the idea that God is that excited about his bride, he's that excited about us, and he can't wait for that day when we're together in heaven. Verse 3 says, I heard a loud shout from the throne saying, look, God's home is now among his people. He will live with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them. Over and over again, throughout the Bible, we see God attempting to live with his people. He walked in the garden with Adam and Eve. He had a presence in the tabernacle with the Israelites. And later he did the same thing in the temple. interestingly enough, the word that we see here in verse 3, where it says God's home is now among his people, is that word tabernacle. It's the same word used to describe the tabernacle. In the New Testament, we see God indwelling believers, indwelling us, in a way that was completely new, that he now lives with us. For the first time since Adam and Eve turned their back on God, he was able to live within a person, within a human being. And I like the way the New Living Translation describes this, as God has made his home. He feels at home now. He's comfortable and relaxed. Now, currently, the truth is that there are corners in our lives where God's not at home. He's uncomfortable. Yeah, we still harbor sin. We still hold on to things that make God feel uncomfortable. As hard as we try to live perfect, holy lives, we fail. And so God continues to live. Yes, he lives within us, but it's not home, not quite. It's still a little uncomfortable. But this verse gives me hope that one day he will be totally at home with us, with his people. In John 17, verse 24, Jesus is praying to the Father, and he says, Father, I want these whom you have given me to be with me where I am. Then they can see all the glory you gave me because you loved me even before the world began. So Jesus, before he went to the cross, he told his Father what he was hoping for. And if you tie that in with Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2, we realize what it was that he's talking about there in Hebrews. He says, we do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. Because of the joy awaiting him, he endured the cross, disregarding its shame. Now he is seated in the place of honor beside God's throne. That joy that was set before him was us being with him. It was him feeling at home with us, that we could be together. That's something worth thinking about. Verse 4, he says, he will wipe every tear from their eyes, and there will be no more death or sorrow or crying or pain. All these things are gone forever. In the future, not only sin, but its effects will disappear. Death, sorrow, crying, and pain are all the results of sin. They're all the effects of sin. And there'll be no more of that. There'll be no more goodbyes. There'll be no more sorrow. There'll be no more longing for loved ones or that sense of loss that we feel. Pain will be gone as the things that cause pain will disappear. It's hard for us to imagine a world like that. It's hard for us to imagine a world where there is no pain. It's such an integral part of our life. Yeah, but God promises himself, he promises to wipe away our tears. This gives me that type of an image that we see on the screen of a small child who just faced some sort of loss. And then mother or father just, you know, grabs that child, doesn't even have to say anything. Just hold them, and the pain goes away. And I think, in that sense, I don't think God will need to say anything to us when we get to heaven. The pain will dissolve, the sorrow will clear up, and we'll know that everything is going to be okay. Verse 5. And the one sitting on the throne said, look, I'm making everything new. And then he said to me, write this down, for what I tell you is trustworthy and true. Jesus speaks to John. He tells him he's going to make everything new. This has at least two implications. Firstly, it means that we're going to be made new. Yeah, all the old messiness that is our current reality is going to be transformed into something that is so much better. Everything that we're facing. Secondly, it means we should hold lightly to everything that is here and now. Remember the blue planet, all those sea creatures that God made? There's not going to be any sea anymore. There's not going to be any sea creatures. And how many things do we have in our lives that we think, oh, you know, that's going to be so sad. So sad to be without this or that. And yet Jesus says, I'm going to make everything new. It's going to be a completely new creation, a new start. So what we cling to now is either going to disappear or it's going to be transformed into something so much better. And for some reason, Jesus says, write this down, this is important. Because I think, he's saying, he wants us to hold things lightly. Yeah, as they say, you can't take it with you. investing in eternity rather than in the things of here and now is such an important thing. That's why we have the end of the story, so that we can know what's coming next. Verses 6 and 7. And he also said, so this is Jesus, he said, "It is finished. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To all who are thirsty, I will give freely from the springs of the water of life. All who are victorious will inherit all these blessings, and I will be their God, and they will be my people, my children." So, Jesus says, this is the end. Yeah, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. But he's not actually saying this is the end of the story. It's interesting, I when I saw that, and that it says, it is finished, I thought, oh, that sounds just like what he did on the cross. Well, it's not, sorry. If you were thinking it was. It's a different word. When he was on the cross, he said, it is finished, and he used the Greek word telio. I'm not a Greek scholar, so I can't pronounce things correctly. Well, that's fine. Probably you aren't either, so you won't know the difference. But the Greek word telio implies the fulfillment of a debt. Paid up. Yeah? It's like paying off your mortgage or finishing your homework, where you can finally sit down and feel relieved, it's done. Yeah? Here in Revelation 21, Jesus uses the word ginomai, which is a verb that carries that same sense of completion, but not out of a sense of obligation that you had to pay your mortgage off, but a sense of completion without that demand. So, like, for example, you fix the car, so now you can drive it. So that sense of anticipation, or when you paint a picture and it's done, but you painted it because you wanted to. So, for me, that was quite significant. For me, it was quite encouraging. He says, it's finished. I'm done. Yeah? Not, well, I've got that paid off now, but now it's like I'm done in anticipation of now of having an eternity with his people. Yeah? And he says, I will be their God, and they will be my children. So he ties up the story in a sense. And I know the series hasn't finished. The big picture continues next week. But he ties up the story. He says, I'm the Alpha and the Omega. I'm the beginning. I was there at the beginning. In Genesis 1, before Genesis 1, I was there. And now, at the end of Revelation, and after Revelation is done, I'm still going to be there. And you're going to be there with me. So he makes it complete with him as the central character of the story, which is the way it should be. And as the story ends, we find that it isn't over for us either. It's not just, this chapter is finishing, but we go on with him, and he says that the victorious will be offered the water of life to quench the thirst. But he's got that covered for us too. Because we read in Romans chapter 8, verse 37, Paul is writing, he says, no, despite all these things, overwhelming victory is ours through Christ, who loved us. So there he is at the end, if you like, at the end of creation. He's saying the victorious get to hang around and get to enjoy this. And if you're not sure if you're one of the victorious ones, look in Romans chapter 8. Yeah, are you there? Overwhelming victory is ours through Christ. Not because we're special people. Not because we earned our way into eternity. But because we're in Christ. We can relax, knowing that because of what Christ has done, the victory is ours. And because the victory is ours, then that opportunity to enjoy the water of life forever and ever is also ours. So the end of the story is overflowing with God's grace. As we think back on the rest of the story, whether we think back on the biblical story and all the times over the generations where people failed God, and yet he continued to pour out his grace on them. Whether that was Adam and Eve, whether that was Abraham or David, the rest of the Israelites. And then we look back on our own personal story. And we realize how many times have we failed God. And yet we see here at the end, he has given us this glorious hope, something to look forward to, something marvelous that we don't deserve, but he's done it because he delights in sharing us with his grace and with his blessing. So the end of the story really isn't the end of the story. It's really just the beginning. And that's all I've got to say. Thank you.